So you can see we're
together tonight. Tomorrow's Ben's birthday, so he has come up tonight, and we're going to celebrate his birthday tonight, and so we're doing it together. Yeah. So this will be fun.
And I tell you what, the Performance Medicine Show treatments, it's different here. Like, you know, there was a meal prepared before the show.
I've got
water here. It's just been so nice.
You have cough drops? You seem better.
Yeah. Thank you guys, to all those who were with us last week. I had to rewatch that, the Q&A last week, and it was painful.
You were starting to get sick.
It was painful. It was painful to watch. So thank you. thank y'all for dealing with me. Diane, thank you. Birthday is tomorrow. Thank you, Linda. So we're celebrating a little bit tonight, and I haven't seen you since your birthday. So we're going to celebrate a little bit.
Great birthday. Thank you.
All right, guys, we're going to get to some questions here. There's about 50 with us right now. So thank you guys for joining us live. We're going to be answering questions here for the next hour or so. And we had a few come in over the week, and we're going to kind of walk through those first. And this is a very common question, Doc. Should men or women ever take a break from hormone therapy? I was recently told it was good to give the body a break from time to time. And I know you get this a lot. And honestly, I would think, you know, maybe take a break, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea, you know, especially if you're really younger, then it's really controversial, because once you get my age, 69 years old, you really don't need to.
Don't need to take a break.
Not really, because you're not going to put out hormones much anyway. And if you're younger than 50, then it's a great idea to take a break, just so that you give your own pituitary gonadal axis a chance to produce some of its own hormones. Mm. But so for younger people, for sure. You know, generally in the course of hormone therapy, whether it's your own cream, shots, pellets, you're automatically going to take a break anyway, because you're probably not going to use the creams, but about 6 nights a week. That's what I recommend usually. So that's a 1 day a week break. You're really not going to develop a tolerance for this, so much. If you're on T shots, you're going to miss a few. You're going to be traveling. The pellets, you know, after a while, you know, after really for women, 4 months, men, maybe 6 months, they're going to run low. Mm. So it's kind of automatic that you do some of that anyway. So, but yeah, I mean, especially if you're younger, it's not a bad idea to take a break, especially if you're considering fertility, that type of thing, then you definitely need to know what you're doing with that. So. A good question.
Yeah, it's a very common question. Thank you so much for sending that in over email. We're going to keep moving here. This is another common question we're getting. What is the time someone is contagious with COVID? And while we're at it, can Dr. Rogers share his protocol for COVID? Our family has been dealing with this for 2 weeks. I know it's out there right now. What are the days where someone who is or has COVID, they're most contagious?
Well, actually, you're more contagious right before you even have symptoms. So that's why it's so hard to know. But probably for about 5 days after you come down with the illness, symptomatic illness. But obviously, if you're coughing all over everybody, you're still running fever, you're still sick, I would still consider you contagious. And so maybe you ought to be wearing a mask right now, Ben. I mean, you're sitting here right in my face.
I know.
You had this thing. You didn't have COVID, but
yeah.
So you're starting to worry me a little bit. I'm kidding. I'm not worried. The protocol, we ought to print the protocol. It's quite extensive, but basically, of course, you're going to bump your vitamin levels really high. You know, I'm big on that I word, which I don't want to mention, because actually they attempted to censor us last week for whatever discussion we had on some of the jabs for other purposes. I think we're talking about tetanus mainly. So we have to be careful with what we say even in these days. The censorship is not over.
No.
That's something that's not over with. So we found that out last week, unfortunately. But due to Ben's persistence and his appealing, they let us back on. So it's a crazy world. You can't tell people what they.
Oh, there we go.
What they think. There's the vitamin protocol. Just
can you,
came.
Can you
up.
Guys see that? All right. So this is kind of walk us through here. 50,000. I've been doing that the last 5 days.
Yeah, the main things. You know, back when COVID was really bad, now it's not so bad at all. You don't have to do all the stuff, but certainly the D, the C, the quercetin, the aspirin are important. Some of the other stuff you really are just, you know, you could add if you wanted, but I really haven't been pushing those too much because I just haven't found you need them. But anyway, so the main things are the high dose D and C for 5 days. I love quercetin. I take the aspirin. And I like to use the ice cream, not really ice cream, but the medicine we call that. And start it as soon as possible. I hate you've been dealing it for 2 weeks. Sometimes if you start early, it works a lot better.
Yeah.
But I hope you get better.
Yeah.
And you will.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing is just knock on wood for most people, not really serious. If you have some underlying medical conditions, then it could certainly cause a problem like the flu can. I really particularly think the flu is a lot more serious than COVID-19 right now.
Yeah.
You're going to get a lot sicker with the flu
than
you are COVID-19 and maybe even RSV.
Yeah.
But so you will get better.
Great question there. Thank you for sending that in. And I hope everybody starts to feel better in the family.
And get outside. Get outside. Really, the sunshine helps, fresh air, movement.
This next question, I want to say this is around the 5-FU. Is that the way you're...
Right. Oh, now it has calcipotriene in it, which makes it a little more tolerable. But, yeah, I really like it. That's the one I use every New Year's. It's a good time to do it now during the winters because you don't want to get out in the sun with it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, great. I do it every year. It really makes me look bad for a week or two, blistery. But
So part of this question is, and I'll post it here in a second, so it's the compounded cream your dad uses usually as a skin peel. It's the 5-FU is what you call it. Has calcipotriene, 0.005%. They're going to be asking about the instructions here. The instructions on the bottle say twice daily for 5 days. Goes on to say, do you apply just a thin coat or heavier? Can you use other moisturizer and sunscreen along with the application? Or is it just this for 5 days? Kind of walk us through
That's a great question. Just use a light, thin coat at night. And, you know, you can wash your face in the morning, of course, and you can use moisturizer or sunscreen. But just at night, after you wash your face, put it on. You don't need anything on top of that. And then in the morning, use your own soap and water, and then use moisturizer and sunscreen if you want. And, again, you can do it for 5 days. I actually don't put it on twice a day. I just did it at night. It'll work just fine. Sometimes you may have to use it for a little bit longer, but I feel that, like I used it for about 10 straight nights instead of using the BID application like it says. And you'll know what kind of reaction you're having. You need to have, unless you don't have any actinic keratosis, because it only lights up the precancerous areas called actinic keratosis. So, in other words, if you don't have any sun damage, it's not going to do anything to your skin. Mm. But I applied it to my face. Now, a lot of people that really can't tolerate it looking that bad for that while, they'll do it for once a day for 5 days and then repeat it, you know, in another 2 weeks. That's a good strategy to kind of clean up the rest of the stuff that may have been left. Now, I did my face, and I also did my hands and arms.
Yeah.
I've had a couple of skin cancers taken off my arms, and I had a lot of sunburns.
Does this can this like help prevent, or is it more of like an exposure?
No, it doesn't prevent.
It just okay.
Yeah,
it seems like it kind of shows that, like, man, you've got some pretty damaged skin, and it's getting rid of that layer.
Exactly right. It'll go right to it. It'll, you know, it doesn't lie. It goes straight to the areas. So, I think it's a great treatment. And then the only prevention's not getting sunburned.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I was reading something. I haven't been concerned just because I'm quasi-young, although Carter today added like 2 years to how old I am today, and, And it kind of got to me.
I know. She thought you were 40 years old.
I was 40.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was taken aback by it.
Yeah, I was kind of taken aback too.
But at the same time, it's like, you know, it was almost like a reality check. Like, okay. Like,
yeah. Maybe you need some Botox. I don't know. Maybe she's saying.
Maybe I need some
Botox.
Maybe
Kelly needs to work on you a little bit.
Carter, I love you. We're going to keep moving here. I think that, okay, this is around the estheticians. Steve, my brother's in here. Steve, I love you, man. Thank you for the birthday wishes. I hope Florida's amazing this week. The question is, I usually get a peel from an esthetician yearly, a Jessner peel. Do you feel the two are about the same? And this is coming from the same listener around the 5FU. What's your...
No. I think they're both great, but definitely I would do the 5FU.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit... it goes more to the areas that need to be gone to. Yeah. So you could check it out. You could get a Jessner first and then follow it up a month later if you want with... the 5FU and see what happens, but I would certainly think about doing both.
Okay. Great questions this week, guys. Thank y'all so much in advance for sending those in. That really gets our show going off.
Kind of warms us up.
It does. It's like, man, now we've got the juices flowing. I'm excited to be here tonight, guys. I'm feeling so much better and I feel like last week you guys got me through it. So thank you.
We have a birthday cake for him tonight after the show. It's a chocolate sheet cake, and so usually don't eat after 7, but tonight we're gonna have to break the rules.
This is true.
Maybe we'll take a walk right afterwards. You know, if you walk for about 10 minutes after you eat a meal, it's really good for you.
It's good for the blood sugar spikes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, very good. And I see Brandon here has a question around A1C's blood sugar spikes. We're gonna get to that here in just a second, Brandon. Thank you for putting that in. We're gonna go to questions here, guys. Thank y'all for being with us. We take live health and wellness questions every Tuesday at 7 o'clock. I'm gonna try and find where I'm at. If I miss anybody throughout the evening, just post it at the end. I'll make sure I get to it. Let's see here. Let's get to Rachel on Facebook. This is another TRT question. Is there a risk for taking anastrozole for men taking TRT and just found out his vitamin D is extremely low? So it seems this is a man on TRT wanting to know, is it risky to take anastrozole with the TRT as well as, you know, is vitamin D a low vitamin D level? Is there any correlation there?
I don't see a correlation to that. I mean, you know, I don't use as much anastrozole as I used to. I used to be very vigilant about keeping that estradiol level between 20 and 30, but actually, you know, because anastrozole can have some side effects, I don't really hit it with anastrozole until you hit really kind of high, near 80 or higher. Then again, I'll always try zinc and maybe something like DIM, broccoli extract, 3IC or one of those. But definitely just needs vitamin D replacement therapy. It shouldn't really affect it.
A low vitamin D level doesn't take long to get back up, from my understanding.
You know, you need to take pretty high doses, you know, to get it up there. So a lot of times if I find a really low vitamin D, I'll give them a shot of D3 to get it built up. Because orally it does take a while. But you're right, vitamin D is a hormone.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything gets better when you take vitamin D. So that's a great comment.
Rachel, thank you for putting that in there.
And I also find that sometimes when I first start T on men, they aromatize to estradiol, but after a while, they quit doing that and they don't need the anastrozole. So I'm not as vigilant about putting a lot of people on anastrozole as I used to be. But obviously, if they have gyno or that type of thing, or their level's really high, then I will. But
now the anastrozole is meant for to stop the testosterone from aromatizing into estradiol.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Out of complete curiosity, what changed your mind? Was it something that you learned in a meeting?
Just talking to these guys. You know, a lot of times that they had side effects, it knocked their libido down, that type of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great question there, Rachel. Thank you so much for putting that in there. let's see, this is another hormone question from Diane. If on HRT, how often should you get hormones checked? That's a great question.
You know, usually a couple months after I start somebody on HRT, I have them pop in just for a check.
Two months.
And then, you know, if I have to adjust it, bump it up or whatever, I like to check it again in about 3 months. And once I have them dialed in every 6 months, you should probably get your levels checked. You know, and as far as men, same kind of the same deal. You know, definitely need to keep an eye on their hematocrit and their estradiol levels and their testosterone levels. And I usually check a CMP to keep an eye on kidney, liver function, all that. So good question.
Yeah, the lab question is one I know we get in office every single day. You know, just the importance of, you know, making sure you're checking that what you're doing is working.
Right. You know? Exactly right. So 2 months after starting, then any adjustments, 3 months, and then if you're dialed in every 6 months.
Diane, thank you so much for putting that in there. All right, let's keep going here, see where I'm at. Yes, D. Lynn, fellow Aquarians. I love it. Lynn's got a question here. Let's see if we can help. What do you think of prolotherapy? And is it worth $250 to $375 per injection? Doc, I know I've heard you talk about prolotherapy. Explain once again kind of what it is.
Well, it's injections of different solutions. Usually it's either sugar water or saline. And what it does, it creates an inflammatory response around a joint or tendon. And so it kind of brings healing factors. I definitely prefer PRP to prolotherapy. I'm not against prolotherapy. I just don't think it works as good as PRP. Mm. As far as the price goes, it's cheaper than the PRP, platelet-rich plasma, just because it's just dirt cheap stuff you're injecting it with. You don't have to spin it down and buy all the expensive centrifuges and the stuff that gets it off your from your blood. But so I'm not against it at all. Some people have pretty good results from it. And some people do both. But I don't think it's as proven as the PRP therapy, which is about $500 a joint.
So the prolotherapy and PRP are kind of same sort of thing?
In a way.
Okay.
Yeah, but
I think differently.
The PRP has its kind of own little stem cells in it. And I've just seen better results with that. Not that I'm against prolotherapy. Try it. It's definitely a little bit cheaper.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you, Lynn, for that question. Stan over on Facebook, I know Doc has talked before about grounding and earthing. He talked about a couple of books. Does he use a grounding mat for the bed? Could he recommend some things that would work? I believe you have some sort of grounding device.
I do. I have one for my own bed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that you plug in and it grounds your bed. And you have one on your pillow, which I have. You know, I think it's a good thing. You know, they're not cheap, but it's hard to quantitize if you think it's working or not. You know, kind of like, you know, devices to remove EMF from your bedroom and stuff like that, or your whole house. So, you know, I think more importantly is just when you're talking about earthing is just walking in your bare feet, you know, walking around. First thing you do when you get up in the morning, go outside, kind of stare into the sun. You know, you're not going to want to, you know, burn your retinas out, but you're not going to do that early in the morning. Don't stare directly at it, just around it, you know, for a good 10 minutes when you get up, no matter what time of year it is. It's great for you. That's just probably as good as anything you can do in that regard, I think. But definitely, you know, get out in nature and walk around, and you don't have to do it in your bare feet. You can get in some grounding shoes or moccasins, that type of thing. You know, we've got a strong connection with the earth, and not only by gravity, but by electrical forces as well. And when we wear these tennis shoes that have a lot of rubber on them that thick, it prevents you from really connecting to the earth. There's really a lot to it.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I forget the name of the book that I read about that. I'll try to.
Isn't it called Earthing or something?
It might be called Earthing. I've probably done a podcast on it before. Yeah. You might want to Google that, the Common Sense MD with grounding or earthing, and I'm pretty sure I did a podcast on that a few years ago. But, it probably helps, definitely.
I think so much of this is like, you know, trying things, and, you know, it might change somebody's life, you know, but also the next person, it might, you know, not have as much of a noticeable effect.
Yeah, it's really hard to know.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to get that thing for your mattress and the next day wake up feeling like a different person.
Yeah.
But we all are electrical beings.
Yeah.
I mean, when you talk about each cell depends on that electron transport chain where electrons fly off, they create free radicals, and they get oxidized and your body kind of rust. A lot of that is trying to prevent that oxidation from free radicals. So that's a great question.
Thank you so much, Stan, for that. I'm seeing Lisa shared. Thank you, Lisa. We certainly appreciate that. I see Heather's in here. Heather, I miss you. It's so good to see you over in Georgia. Let's see. Where are we at here? Tabitha, what's going on from Kingsport? I love you. Thank you for being here. Let's get to Bianca. This is a water question. I'll read it for you, Doc. Back to last week for a second. The water issue has me confused. It seems that most whole house systems remove contaminants like chlorine, chloramine, PFOA, and PFOS, pesticides, herbicides, heavy acetic acids, etc., but not fluoride. The RO does remove fluoride, yet also removes the beneficial things like calcium and magnesium. So if I use RO in my kitchen, in addition to the whole house filter, then I am also filtering out the good stuff, okay? You definitely said you weren't a fan of the fluoride. And one thing I will add, if there's anybody in here in the live tonight who has a lot of experience with, you know, water filters, go ahead and put some comments in the comments there if you found something that really works. What's your thoughts on this? Because I get what she's saying.
That's a good comment. But you really don't need more calcium through your water. You really don't. You know, you can get that through your foods. I don't even like calcium supplements. Now, magnesium, which you can also get in foods, I am up for the supplement on that you take at night. So I wouldn't really worry about filtering that out of your water. You know, the big thing is, like you say, you need to get all the other stuff out, and the reverse osmosis certainly takes out fluoride, which, you know, if you do a dive on that, and I hope to do a podcast on that with a real expert on that very soon, if I can get her to do it.
Yeah.
A lady from Asheville.
Yep.
So stay tuned for more on fluoride, because there may be a little bit of good stuff, but a lot of bad stuff. So I think you're on the right track with what you're doing there. So I wouldn't worry too much about the calcium and magnesium. I think you're doing a good job there. It's just the Brita is not going to filter out your fluoride. You know, the one that clearly filtered that I use, it does. So, great question.
Thank you for putting that in there, Bianca. Velma is asking, can tooth infection cause blood pressure spikes? Going to the dentist can, I know that. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it does on you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Ben's pressure goes out the roof if he goes to the dentist. That's why he doesn't go very much.
That's changing in 2024, though.
But yeah, it certainly can. I saw somebody today with a lot of problems with their teeth, which they blame for setting off a whole cascade of autoimmune reactions in her body. She had to have like 3 root canals. She's had 9 crowns, and she just has a terrible time with her teeth. And one of them's chronically infected. Mm. And I sent her to Dr. Creech, who I've done a podcast with for salivary bacteria testing, and hopefully she can help her with that. That's a perfect patient for that. But it certainly can. Any kind of infection or inflammation can spike your blood pressure. I mean, a lot of times people have hypertension just because of their family history, despite doing everything they can, like exercise, stay lean, eat right, sleep, But yeah, it certainly can. There's a lot of damage that an infected tooth can do to your heart as well. I mean, you could actually blame a lot of heart disease on infection in your teeth,
yeah, I believe,
and sinuses.
That's really what's kind of spurring my ambition to really take care of my teeth this year. Velma, thank you so much for putting that in there and kind of teeing us up for that conversation.
Well, let's try to relax. If your blood pressure just goes up when you're getting a checkup or go to the doctor or dentist and it's okay at home, that's probably white coat hypertension. So you shouldn't worry too much about that.
This question from Brandon is a great one. How bad is a A1C number of 6.6? Should I be on medication or keep trying to bring it down? Thank you, Brandon, for putting this in here. Doc, what's your thoughts?
It's a great question. Yeah, you know, anything over 6.5 is, quote, diabetes, but, you know, it's just a spectrum. So you've got definitely insulin resistance, whether you call it type 2 diabetes or you call it pre-diabetes, it doesn't matter. You need to get it down. If you can't get it down with diet and exercise and weight loss, certainly there's some things that can help you do it. The first thing I would get on would be berberine, which in my opinion is about as good as, or maybe better than metformin. I get about as good numbers with a lot less side effects. And I don't see some of the muscle loss or CoQ10 depletion I see with metformin. Metformin's good and bad. I had a discussion with a patient today about metformin. There is good and there's bad with it. It's certainly an effective treatment to lower your A1C. But the first thing is always diet, low carb, exercise. You know, if you're really, you could be getting your A1C, you may be very lean and eat pretty well. It could be some genetic tendencies that you have. If you're really overweight and haven't had any success, you certainly Ozempic or Mounjaro, just amazing medications to bring that down. I started somebody just like you today on that. They had no clue they were a diabetic. And they were a little, you know, fairly overweight, just in the gut mainly. But so that's a great question. You may need to be on a medication. Certainly, even with, you know, if you can try, if you're borderline and want to try something natural, certainly I like to start out with that. But these medications like Ozempic and Mounjaro, I'm not against them at all. We use it a lot, and it really helps overcome that insulin resistance when nothing else is working for you. There's also a lot of great evidence that shows that it cuts down on heart cardiac events, reverses non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, protects your kidneys. Yep. May even be great for dementia and alcoholism. So we certainly use a lot of it and have had great results on it. And so, but yeah, try that and see. Eat low carb, try berberine, exercise, get a good night's sleep, see what happens. And wear a Freestyle Libre continuous glucose monitor for a while. I prescribed two of those today, and they're very helpful. Very helpful to know what spikes your sugar. Remember, it's not just your A1C, which is a 3-month average of blood sugar. It's really the damage is done when you're spiking, especially those postprandial after meal spikes of your sugar levels. That's what inflames your arteries and causes all the damage. So it's time under the curve is what I like to put it. It's not just A1C, you know, it's preventing those spikes.
I got this question the other day. When you get on a medication like Ozempic, Wegovy, are you still of the mindset that you can get off, but also for some people it is kind of a more long-term medication?
Possibly. I've seen people do it.
You can't get off?
Possibly.
Okay.
You know, most people that are diabetic, pre-diabetic, really suffer from obesity. I recommend they just stay on it.
Yeah.
Because too many times I've seen them gain the weight back. And again, like I said, it's not their fault. It's a metabolism problem. It's a gut hormone problem. So, you know, unless you're having too many side effects from it, work your dose up and just stay on it for most people.
Brandon, I hope that helps. Thank you for putting in the question. Let's see here where we are at. Let's see here. Angie, I see you. Thank you so much. There's Vicky's question. Do you have any information on research of symbiotic SIM01 that effectively alleviates post-COVID symptoms and improves gut microbiome imbalances?
It must be a gut pill. I guess it's a combination of probiotic, prebiotics. I'm not sure. I don't have anything that I can say about it because I'm not informed about it. But certainly, I'll write that down and do some research on it. I definitely know from personal experience that COVID can really disrupt your gut microbiome. I mean, yeah. Incredibly. I had it for like 9 months after my second bout of COVID, which is a mild cold, but it led to some gut imbalances. Fortunately, I did a GI map and, you know, tried some different things, and it helped. It finally cleared up. But really, I thought I was having some real problems. I'm pretty sure it caused me a little microscopic colitis.
Yep.
Although when I had my colon looked at, of course, you can't see that. They didn't see anything, didn't get a biopsy. But yeah, so I've got a lot of experience personally in that realm. But I don't know. I'll look up the SIM01. That's what it's called, and see. It may have some of the stuff that we're already using.
Vicky, thank you for that. We're going to take note of the symbiotic SIM01. See if we can learn anything more about that for you. Heather is asking, are you concerned about long-term effects of Mounjaro on the pancreas? Certainly, we know about the thyroid cancer risk as well. Also, any thoughts on the stellate ganglion blocks for anxiety / PTSD? So this is another question around the GLP-1s with Mounjaro, the GLP-1 and the GIP.
Yeah. Of course, you know, there haven't been any really long-term studies with it. But, you know, certainly if you have any history of pancreatitis, you don't want to take that class of medications. I prescribed it thousands of times. I think I've only seen two cases of what I thought may be pancreatitis that got normal after you stopped it. Thyroid cancer risk, you know, I really don't think there's a risk for thyroid cancer. You just don't want to take it. If you've had a history of medullary cancer of the thyroid, which is really, really rare, you know, most cancer surgeons, thyroid cancer surgeons, like my brother, never saw a case in their whole career of medullary, plenty of other papillary follicular, but not medullary. So that's rare. Or if you have if you've had a history of MEN syndrome number 2 or a family with that, which does include thyroid cancer, you ought to avoid it. But again, that's rare, but it's certainly worth asking. So again, with any medicine, especially one like this, you have to weigh the benefits versus the risk. And certainly for most people that I see, the benefits are way, way greater than the risk of it. Like I say, I would like to do anything more naturally if I could, but some people just can't. It's not their fault. They just can't do it. But the stellate ganglion blocks, I've heard good things about it. You know, not doing them, I don't have any firsthand experience with it, but there's a lot of really good studies that have showed positive results from it. They've even done ganglion blocks to bring back post-COVID loss of taste and smell. Mm. And there's another exciting class of medications for anxiety, PTSD, and that's, here are the dogs, and that is use of the psychedelics medications like psilocybin and some of the other medications that I won't mention, but that you think of as hardcore drugs. But ketamine is certainly one of them. But stay tuned. I hope to get an expert on and talk about some of the stuff that you can do that's really outside of the box for that. Because some people really suffer from that, and makes their life really miserable. They're at risk for suicide and that type of thing. So, yeah, I've heard good reports about it, and certainly for people that don't respond to anything else, really worth seeing an expert about.
Yeah. Great question, Heather. Thank you so much for putting that in there. We're going to keep going here. Let's see where I'm at. I'm going to go to Mike over on YouTube. Shout out to the YouTube people tonight. Good evening. Just wanted to ask, is red light therapy safe for someone with a cancer diagnosis?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, it's probably good for your cancer.
Even skin cancer?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not going to burn your skin. I think there's so many benefits from red light therapy. You know, I certainly have one of my own infrared sauna, plus the red light therapy, and I have a handheld device that I use for red light therapy. It's great for, it's a great anti-inflammatory.
Yeah.
It's great for promoting stem cell activation and collagen production. So it's not just good for, you know, your skin and all. It's good for a lot of other things too. So I don't have any specific, you know, things that I would say it would be harmful for. Certainly if you're undergoing radiation, check with your radiation oncologist at see about concurrent use with it. So I'd probably definitely check that out. It can't hurt to question that. But great question.
Thank you for that, Mike. Over on YouTube, let's get to Vicky here. Is it safe to take low-dose aspirin if you are allergic to ibuprofen?
Probably. You know, there are two different medications there, and certainly, you know, keep your eyes peeled. You know, again, if you have an allergic, like a severe allergic reaction, like anaphylaxis to ibuprofen, then before you start any other anti-inflammatory, you know, you should maybe take precautions, have some Benadryl around, and maybe an EpiPen, which you should have if you've had any kind of anaphylaxis in the past.
Yeah.
I have, believe me. And again, I told a patient today that we're really kind of worried about anaphylaxis. And I told him, well, if you're taking something new, come in, you know, to my office and sit in the lobby and take it and just wait.
Yeah.
You know, that way you'll feel safe. We can certainly reverse, you know, reaction. So sometimes it makes people feel better.
Yeah. I love that. Thank
you for
saying
that. Or your own doctor, you know, if you have a doctor and you don't come see us. But that's a really good question. And if you're just totally paranoid about it, there's other options like natokinase. I really like that one as a more of an alternative to aspirin. It's a good, safe blood thinner. Mm.
Vicky, thank you so much for that. Let's see here. Sorry about the phone call. All right, let's keep moving. I see Edith has a great question. Does anyone in your office treat complicated mast cell issues after effect of long-haul COVID? No doctor of allergy or family or functional has been able to help cause, not familiar with mast cell complications. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, there's something called MCAS, mast cell activation syndrome, that's pretty common. But certainly, yeah, I mean, we do work with that. I mean, there's a lot of thing. There's no magic bullet for that, but certainly it can be addressed in our offices. I think Margo's treated some of that specifically, but in our Fountain City office. So, yeah, I mean, it certainly can be, you know, treated for sure. Mm. But it can get complex. It can be a lot of triggers. You know, that and multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome are really tough, but they can always be, you know, worked on and looked at.
Edith, thank you for that question. Let's go to my brother Steve here. If people drink only RO water, should they be concerned about a lack of minerals?
Steve, that's the second time that's come up tonight. And a good question. You know, certainly, you know, it's going to filter out some of the calcium, you know, and magnesium. But like I say, I don't like extra calcium. Magnesium you can get through your foods you take a, every adult probably should be on a magnesium supplement at night anyway, but no, so I don't think so. I really don't. As long as you eat a great diet, I don't think you should be really worried about that.
Thank you, Steve, for that question.
If you are, if you sweat a lot and all, you can certainly, you know, drink, have some mineral water.
Yeah.
Instead, you know, that to your, I actually have a little trace mineral dropper that I put in my water, you know, once every day or so.
Is that like Elementi? Is Elementi a mineral, or is it, it's more electrolytes?
I think that's more electrolytes. Okay. This, the one I have has, you know, like trace minerals like copper, zinc, and things like that. Manganese, boron.
All right, let's get to Becky here. Mark, thank you so much, man. I appreciate you. Becky's asking, my daughter has elevated levels of iron and B12, seems 1902. She also has, both C677T and A1298C MTHFR variants. Does this need to be treated? And if so, how, what are these numbers here?
Well, you know, the B12 level of 1902 is, you know, on a high level of B12, she's probably getting some B12 in either, you know, something she's eating or supplementation maybe. But that doesn't bother me at all. You know, when somebody has a high B12 level, it just means they're getting B12. Mm. It's a water-soluble vitamin. I don't worry about it at all. You're not going to get toxic on B12. Certainly, if she has the genetic variation, like most people do, I mean, 50% of people have one or two of those mutations. So, you know, the main thing on that is looking at homocysteine levels and making sure they're low. And sometime if I really want to get into the woods, I'll check a COMT gene as well and see if they need to be on something extra like SAMe or something like that. You know, it seems like the 677T mutations more associated with clot formation, inflammation.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
That type of thing. And the 1298 is more associated with more mood disturbances. But again, one copy of each is not a bad deal. Certainly the worst mutations, double mutation of 677TT, which I have personally with a high homocysteine level. So, of course, I take methylcobalamin, methylfolate. I also take TMG, trimethylglycine. And I do have one mutation on the COMT gene that's the reason I started a little SAMe as well. But as far as the level of iron, you know, it depends on if it's the iron or the ferritin, you know, and look and see what the blood complete blood count with differential looks like. Certainly, there's a lot of interrelated factors with that. What's the hemoglobin hematocrit? What's the MCV, MCHC? What the folate level is, and certainly B6 is another one she needs to be on, pyridoxal. But yeah, she probably needs to come in and see somebody who knows something about this, because your average doctor is not going to know much about it. So, especially on those genetic mutations of the MTHFR, which are very important.
Yeah.
So yeah, she needs to come in and see somebody that knows what they're talking about.
Becky, thank you so much for putting that in there. I hope that helps. Let's see here. Mark is asking, we're seeing an increase in Mycobacterium tuberculosis across the country. Any thoughts on the symptoms, prevention, and treatments? What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, tuberculosis. You know, that's something that, you know, does pop up occasionally. You usually don't vaccinate it against it here in this country since it's so rare, but it's something that's very contagious. And there's been some question about whether some of the migration patterns that are happening in our country may be bringing some of this in. In certain other countries, they do vaccinate against it. I think it's BCG vaccine, which they don't really give too much in this country. And it's hard to pick up because you have to do skin testing, you know, to see if you have an active infection, and then sometimes followed by an X-ray sputum sample and all that. So it's not eradicated, but, you know, you read something every once in a while. It's not big news, but you kind of wonder if we're going to get more of an influx of it from migration patterns and things like that, or maybe even COVID knocking down some immunity, which could be related. So it's certainly something to keep a heads up about.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get pretty sick. You can really have a cavitary pneumonias. That's the sine qua non of what you'll see on an x-ray is a cavitary lesion on your chest x-ray. Prevention, it's contagious. You know, knowing when there and where there's an outbreak. And treatments, I think, knock on wood, I've never had to treat a case of it, but I'm pretty sure it's a long course of four or five different kinds of antibiotics so it's hard to treat. It's hard to pick up on it, and it's hard to treat it. Mm. But certainly it's very contagious, so that's a good point,
yeah.
You know, where you don't think about it too much. So,
Mark, thank you for putting that in there. We're going to go to Darren over on Facebook. Any supplements you would recommend to help prevent bowel obstructions?
Yeah, great
yeah,
question,
really
especially
question.
If you're prone to that. If you're prone to that, you need to be eating fiber. You know, fiber is an odd thing. Some people fiber really helps. Some people fiber makes worse. It just bloats them more. But, you know, if you tend to be constipated, my favorite medicine for that is Dr. Schultz's intestinal formula number one. It's purely herbal. It's great. It's not a stimulant, laxative. I always go back to my old gold standard, which is DigestShield for most bowel problems, especially it helps constipation, it helps GERD, it's a prebiotic, a probiotic, it's a digestive enzyme, which helps you emulsify fats. Then you have your gluten blocker, it's got lactase, which blocks dairy. So it's a good play. It's a good for anybody. I put everybody on it. But one thing you also may want to be aware of, if you tend to be constipated, and certainly if you've had bowel obstructions, you've read cases of where Ozempic can cause bowel obstruction as well, because they slow gastric emptying. So always be aware of that as well. So look at Dr. Schultz's. It has a lot of good things in it that really help. That and the combination with DigestShield would probably be my top two. And always fiber.
Darren, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for that question. I know that's something that affects so many people. I want to give a shout out to Nancy Rowland over with my grandma Mary. Hope you guys are having a blast tonight. Thank you for watching. Let's get to Lisa here. Let's see, Lisa. Female, late 50s, past menopause with what feels like a chronic vaginitis, vulvaginitis. Would a hormone-type therapy cream help relieve symptoms and be safe to use, or would you recommend something different? GYN acts like he doesn't want to prescribe any hormone-type therapy. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in hormone therapy. Again, for vaginal dryness, estriol is a preferred cream that we use. But certainly, you know, there can be some other things that can take care of a vaginitis, which is a chronic irritation. Hopefully your GYN's done, you know, smears and cultures to make sure it's not a chronic yeast infection or trichomonas, something like that, or some of the other bacterial infections that require more of an antifungal or antibiotic treatment. But there, it sounds like boric acid is a harsh treatment, but sometimes some of the compounders use something like that. That will get rid of a lot of that. But it definitely needs to be looked at and maybe even biopsied by your GYN just to make sure what it is. Certainly, I do like hormone creams, especially estriol, for that type of problem. Mm. And there's some other things you could probably do for it. You know, some people, you know, are kind of allergic to their own sweat, and that'll bring on something like that. It becomes a chronic cycling thing.
Yeah.
But if they won't treat you, you know, we can certainly try some things to to look at. And certainly we treat, I'm a huge believer in hormone therapy. Again, a lot of the gynos are just scared about it because they didn't really look too closely at the WHI study and what it represented, you know, 14 years ago. So certainly hormone therapy is very valuable. I mean, prevents UTIs. You know, women die, they can die from UTIs. They can die from vaginal dryness.
Really?
Yeah, they can, because they can get infected, they can get septic, they can die.
Huh.
A UTI in an older woman could kill them. So certainly needs to be looked into.
Yeah. Lisa, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for putting that question in. Let's get to Steven here over on YouTube. Other than turmeric, what are good natural anti-inflammatory supplements?
Before I answer that question, I want to go back to Lisa's.
Yeah.
I always go back to something my dad told me, who was a physician. And this doctor, in your case, should take this advice. If you're not sure what to do, do something. It sounds like they're not doing anything for you.
Yeah.
Go to somebody who actually try something. It's crazy to me that they won't try something.
And I'm seeing here from Heather also seems to be thinking the same thing.
Yeah, boric acid. That's what I just said. Yeah. I go with you, Heather, on that one. Consider a new GYN, you know.
Yeah, thank you, Heather,
great,
for that.
Great comment.
Let's go to, okay, let's go back to Steven here. Other than turmeric, what are other good natural anti-inflammatory supplements?
Turmeric's certainly my favorite. I really like MSM a lot. That's a really good one. And I think some of the adrenal adaptogens like ashwagandha work pretty good with it too. I'm trying to think of some of the others that are in some of these combo medications, some of the arthritis. They have all kinds of stuff in them, like dandelion and, what kind of green tea extract. I like omega-3s. I like natokinase. I like serapeptase. You know, God, there's so many good ones. I ran into one of my patients had some great results from taking a vitamin from a company called Solgar. And it was, I think,
yeah,
it was
Solgar.
It's a good vitamin company. It was called, I think it was Arthritis Supplement Number 7, I think they called it. And I actually ordered one, a bottle of it, just to try on some people that I know. Just to see, and I looked at the ingredients, and there's a ton of stuff in there, all herbal. So look at that, and I always eat a non-inflammatory diet. I think that may be as important as anything. A lot of times when people cut glutens out and dairy and nightshades, is that what it is?
That's what Katie's saying. Joint 7 is the...
Joint 7?
Yeah, from the Solgard.
Yeah.
That's cool. Thank you, Katie.
But look at your diet real closely. I can't tell you how many times people have gone on a semi-auto immune diet and really helped them a lot. Come talk to, if you're unsure about your diet, what you should be eating, come talk to Lucas in our Johnson City office, our dietitian. He's amazing in his knowledge about this stuff.
I'm going to put this up from Bianca because it has to do with what we're just talking about. Can you take too much turmeric curcumin?
You could. Yeah, you could. It could really cause some GI upset.
Yeah.
A lot of GERD and things like that. I've seen people do too much of it.
It's definitely such a thing as too much of a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. Just like you could take too much B6 and cause, you take B6 for neuropathy, you take too much of it, it can cause neuropathy. So there's a window there.
Let's get to Trevor here. What are your thoughts on taking acromantia?
Acromantia. Man, I'm going to have to look that one up again. It's not coming. It's not clicking in my head right now. Let's put that down for next week.
Trevor, thank you. Thank you. We're gonna get to that next week. That gives us something to
I've heard to of it, up. But yeah. I'm afraid to talk about it because it just doesn't pop into my head, you know, what to say about it. So
thank you, Trevor, for that. We'll get to that next week. Let's see here. I'm going to get to Steve has a question here. How does one know if they're getting enough potassium?
Well, you can, you know, check your blood level and see.
Is it an actual potassium level?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. That's in a basic metabolic panel. We check them all the time. You know, if you're on a diuretic, you can deplete your potassium. People think that a lot of muscle cramps come from low potassium, and they can. Then they start eating bananas with all the sugar, when actually it's more of a sodium problem. So certainly if you're on a medication that can deplete potassium, you should get a basic metabolic panel, which is electrolytes, sodium, potassium, that type of thing.
Thank you, Steve, for that question. Let's see where we're at here. Let's see if I've missed anybody. I agree with you, Katie. We need an anti-inflammatory vitamin. Let's see. There we go. I think we are. I think we are good. I see. Roel, we're TBD. TBD on the online. There we're so close.
Very close. We're this close.
I can't say that. And I'll defer to Katie on this one. So however Katie answers it is what I'm going to go with. But I can tell you, Roel, we are extremely close.
If they're not this week, it'll be
close.
I hate to promise, but yeah, it's going to be good.
It'll be close.
And we're really going to give some good deals on them too.
Yeah.
I really think we have some of the best vitamins in the world. I really do. I think our Super Multi is the best multivitamin in the world.
Yeah.
I'm going to go on record right now saying that.
Guys, y'all heard it here first.
I may get censored for saying that by some of the big pharma. Who knows?
That's a big claim. guys,
look at the ingredients.
I see Roel's got a question here. Thank you, Roel. Doctor, is there a test checking sodium levels?
Yeah, it's in a complete metabolic or basic metabolic panel, certainly.
All right, Katie's saying here within 2 weeks or less. Thank you, Katie, for confirming that for us. So stay tuned on that. We'll make some big announcements on here, but within the next 2 weeks. Thank you.
Ben, they say it's your birthday. Let's go get some cake.
Guys,
let's do this as a final party thing. It's been such a good Q&A. We're going to hold the microphones up
and let's just drop them in the floor.
You know, like they do on The Voice. Where
is this what they call the mic drop?
This is the mic drop. You know, it's our best show ever.
Guys, how did we do? Is it mic drop worthy? Was this?
We'll have to put that out to them.
Oh no.
You better sign off before you get embarrassed.
Don't go away.